And this is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Socialist iconic scholar and activist Angela Davis takes on Trump in the stirring call for protest, linking his victory to America's history of racism and capitalism. She builds bridges between numerous issues and ongoing movements for social change, starting with support for Native Americans, Black Lives Matter, ending mass incarceration and the death penalty, feminism, labor, immigration, and the environment. She calls for robust protests, not organized from the elite, but based upon community and workplace activism, to fight not only Trump, but also a system built on racism and capitalism. And she notes that Clinton's support, even among women, was at best tepid, because she adhered to a bourgeois or middle-class feminism that played down the needs of working class and women of color. And now, Angela Davis on Trump, trying to make America white again.
I want to pay tribute to the indigenous people on whose land we gather. As we contemplate the struggles ahead, as we reflect on the long history of freedom struggles that define the presence of people of African descent, let us also celebrate the determination of First Nations people to protect their land, their culture, their future. And so we stand together with the Standing Rock Sioux in defense of their land, in defense of their water. So much of what is important, so much of what has actually acquired historical significance has been achieved through mass struggle. Yes. Certainly during the last 4 years since we rose up in protest of the killing of Trayvon Martin, the movement for prison abolition, and I don't simply say against mass incarceration, I say prison abolition. Which is also a contestation of carceral feminism. The movement against racist police violence, for black lives, for immigrant rights, against Islamophobia, for feminist movements, more broadly, movements in defense of the rights of trans people, opposition to gender violence, opposition to oil pipelines, especially the Dakota Access Pipeline, student struggles, especially for accessible education. And accessible education means free education. Movements for justice for Palestine. Movements in solidarity with black women in Colombia, in Brazil. And I'm just beginning to enumerate the struggles. And I haven't mentioned that considering all of the justice struggles we're involved in, there is one struggle that you might define as ground zero, and that is the struggle to save the planet. Yes. The environmental movement, environmental justice. What was once proclaimed as the advent of a post-racial era. Do you remember? Not very long ago. And it's interesting that that turned out to mark the beginning of a new militancy. Yes. And a recognition of structural racism. and a new approach to struggles for justice that recognizes the intersectionality of all of our struggles. We celebrate our own potential as agents of history in a collective quest for freedom at a time when the forces of capitalism, fueled as they are by racism and heteropatriarchy, threaten to push us back. If there is ever to be any greatness on America's agenda, it must be in the future. And it will consist precisely in the overcoming of the capitalist forces that have impoverished not only so many people in this country, but people all over the world. We know what we have to do, considering the person who will be occupying the White House over the next period represents precisely those forces of capitalism that have impoverished so many of the people who decided to vote for him because they feared for their future. I agree with John Lewis. Is not only an illegitimate president because of what the Russians may have done. His victory was predicated on an institution called the Electoral College, which is an institution of slavery. It was designed to give slave states with small white populations the leverage they needed to acquire power at the national level. In many ways, the inheritances of slavery are still with us. And I think we are beginning to recognize that if we hope to move forward, we will have to get rid of those inheritances. But we have so many relics of slavery that we don't question. For example, the continued use of the death penalty is yet another relic of slavery. Slavery as an institution preserved capital punishment at a time when people upholding this new democracy were arguing that it was an institution that needed to be relegated to the dustbin of history. The death penalty served a very important purpose in repressing slaves who were attempting to achieve their freedom. And we should never forget that the U.S. as a nation was founded on settler colonialism and slavery. And as we talk about these historical modes of oppression, it's important to think in a more complicated way and to see how anti-Black and anti-Indigenous practices are supported and sustained. You know, oftentimes we assume that there are these discrete histories that didn't have anything to do with each other. We have to begin to rethink the history of Black people's presence in this part of the world and understand how closely linked that history is to the history of Indigenous people. And that also means that we will then more clearly recognize how important engaging in acts of contemporary solidarity can be in terms of building the kind of struggle that will allow us to envision the future. We have a lot of work ahead of us.
You know, Donald Trump is going to move into the White House. And there are those who assume that, oh, yes, there's always been a peaceful transfer of power. And this is how we define democracy in the U.S. But, you know, Donald Trump hasn't been so peaceful, has he? You know, particularly in the ways in which he has called for the building of a wall and repeatedly referring to Mexican immigrants as murderers and rapists. So I like the idea of living the legacy of nonviolence. But I also like Dr. King's idea of dramatizing the forms of oppression that exist and making certain that nobody can look away. So our goal is to guarantee that Donald Trump will not be able to govern comfortably. Prepared to stand up. We have to be prepared to show our bodies and let our voices be heard. If you think you've been to a lot of demonstrations in the past, well, multiply that by 100 or 1,000 over the next period. Yes, we are going to have to figure out how to stand together with immigrants who are under attack. That is our responsibility. And we should recognize that the attack on immigrants is a global issue. You know, understand the connection between the attack on immigrants from Central America, from Mexico, Central America, and Haiti, and other areas of the Americas, and what is happening in Europe now. Immigrants from Syria, from Africa. And we have to recognize that at bottom, it is about the inability of capitalism to provide the means with which people can live humane lives. This is an era, of course, in which everything has been globalized, and you're taught to praise globalization. Capital travels across borders, and knowledge travels across borders. Products travel across borders. But what happens when people whose ability to live their lives is usurped by these movements of capital? What happens when people then feel impelled to move across borders in order to guarantee futures for themselves and their families? They're called illegals. People, you know, try to live in the only way that has become possible in this era. They're referred to as illegals. So there should be no use of that term. No one is illegal. No human being is illegal. And then when we see the ideological equation of Islam and terrorism, and particularly the attacks emanating from Donald Trump against Muslims and people who look like they might want to practice Islam, because it's actually a much broader attack. And then recognizing that with respect to Islamophobia, it's women who are the first targets. It's women who are the first targets. And some of you saw that photographic image of the armed policeman on the beach in Nice, France, forcing a woman who was wearing a burkini to take off her clothes. This was barely a month after the terrible attack happened in Nice. This woman and her desire to enjoy the beach bore responsibility for the deaths that happened in Nice on Bastille Day. There was a lot of talk about women during the election. You remember? And then after the election, there were those who proclaimed that even though Hillary Clinton, the woman running for office, lost, that 54% of women voted for Clinton, 42% of women voted for Donald Trump. But what is the real story behind these statistics? Because even though it's true that 54% of women voted for Clinton, 53% of white women voted for Trump. And this was supposed to be the era of feminism, right? But so how do we end up with this figure of the majority of women voting against Trump? Do you understand how that happened? It happened because 94% of black women, 94% of black women voted against Donald Trump. And it's not because I'm a black woman that I say that black women are the most sophisticated, the most strategic participants in our political realm. And thank you, my brother. And I think that men, progressive men, should applaud that. Percent of Latina women voted against Trump. The majority of Latina women. But Hillary Clinton was deeply mistaken in thinking that she could use an obsolete notion of feminism. You see, many of those black women who voted for Hillary Clinton did not think that she was their candidate. And I voted for her, but it was a strategic vote. It was a vote designed to prevent the election of Donald Trump. It wasn't a vote for Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton was deeply mistaken in thinking that she could call up this obsolete notion of feminism that focuses on what you might call the categorical woman, and the categorical woman is always racialized, right? When you speak about women, you know, who are you really talking about? And it seems to me that she used this outmoded notion of feminism that revolves around white middle-class women, bourgeois women. And even the notion of shattering the glass ceiling was predicated on the assumption that she was speaking for the women who were all the way up close to the ceiling. And all they had to do was speak for. What about all of those women below? Those are the women she should have appealed to. She also didn't use the word capitalism. Did she use the word capitalism ever? In a critical context?
Hell no.
Well, you know, that was Bernie Sanders who, and that was good. That was good that he did this radical critique of capitalism. But he didn't understand what scholar Cedric Robinson called racial capitalism. He didn't understand that all capitalism is racial capitalism, and you cannot talk about capitalism.
feminism without also talking about racism. And I just wanted to say a few words about how, when we think about the labor movement, who do we think about? We assume that if the labor movement is ever to be revitalized, it's going to be working class men out there. And we don't realize that the world has changed. We've witnessed the feminization of the global workforce. Not only in terms of the women who are working, but the nature of the jobs. We're talking about domestic work.
Yes.
I will evoke those women back in Montgomery. We're talking about care work. We're talking about reproductive labor. And if the labor movement is ever to rise again, it has to recognize that to organize the unorganized in this day and age means to organize women. Yeah. That is where the strength is going to come from. Let's think about how change happens. You know, unfortunately, the most intense politicization of people in this country happens around the time of elections. I think elections are absolutely important. But the best elected officials are those who acknowledge the fact that change comes from below. Change comes from movement. Change comes from mass struggle. And we have to stop assuming that all we have to do is vote for the candidate who will bring change. It will never come. Was slavery abolished as a result of a politician or two or three or four? Abraham Lincoln didn't abolish slavery. The abolitionist movement, and particularly the black abolitionist movement. Black people who were slaves, who engaged in what Du Bois called a general strike. That is what abolished slavery. Did white women receive the vote? And I say white women, because we usually hear the term in 1920, women got the vote, but it was white women who got the vote. So when white women got the vote in 1920, was that simply a result of an act of Congress? No, there was a long history of struggle. Unemployment insurance. People think of that as having come to us through the New Deal, but they don't understand that from the era of the Depression on, people were in the streets and they were marching and they had hunger marches and they challenged the government. That's where it came from. Did black people get the vote in 1965 as a result simply of the passage of an act of Congress? So where does change come from? It is more important now to recognize the dynamics of change than ever. He's going to talk about the ways in which the movement against what we came to call the prison industrial complex emerged. You know, now everybody's talking about mass incarceration, right? Even the conservatives. But there was a time when no one wanted to recognize what was happening in our prisons. But there were activists and artists and scholars who persevered over several decades. And now we recognize that something has to be done to remove these machines of destruction from our landscape. And it's not just about ending mass incarceration. It's about ending incarceration altogether. It's about recognizing that
Under no circumstances have prisons ever been capable of rehabilitating people who are in there. I make these statements knowing that I'm here in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm in the state of Tennessee, which gave the world private prisons. And the Correctional Corporation of America, and then, you know, all of the other private prison companies. And that is connected not only to the crisis we are experiencing in the prison system, but to the detention of immigrants. As a matter of fact, the most profitable sector of the prison industrial complex at this moment is precisely the sector that produces and markets immigrant detention facilities. We have to be prepared to struggle over the next period. We have to stretch our minds and stretch our bodies and our spirits and recognize that we're not just struggling for ourselves as individuals. We're not just struggling for our own families and communities. It is about the world. You know, one of the reasons why we have so many problems in the U.S. is because we fail to recognize the extent to which we are a part of a vast network, what Dr. King called an inescapable mutuality of experiences. And that is going to be, that insight is going to be the insight that allows us to produce the kinds of communities of struggle over the next period that will allow us to get through the next 4 years. Now, when we talk about getting through the next 4 years, because Trump cannot become a two-term president. He cannot become a two-term president. No, but let us also not be myopic in our vision. And let us recognize that the struggles that we are embracing have a very long history. And that history spans for centuries. But also we have to be able to look to the future and recognize that this history will involve decades and centuries in the future. We need to build community, rebuild community. We need new organizations, new struggles. We need to consolidate our communities. We need to recognize that we will have to struggle over the coming period as we have never struggled before. And I'll conclude with the title of the freedom song that Tammy evoked in her introduction. Freedom, after all, is a constant struggle. Thank you very much.
Angela Davis on Trump, trying to make America white again.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.